Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live, a little bit more of an exciting Friday afternoon than we'd like. Some interesting video and audio things going on here in the studio, but we've been working through it. And Jimmy's mostly had to try to ignore it while we while he answers questions. So it's like a degree of difficulty show today. Let's see how difficult can we make it on Jimmy. But we've got lots more questions. Maybe we've got it straightened out and it'll work this hour. 888-318-7884 is the number. I'm only saying that for one person because there's one line open. So I don't know who you are, but go ahead and call it. 888-318-7884. Jimmy, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Got a new podcast, the Jimmy Akin Podcast. Just started this year. Earlier in the fall, and we'll continue into perpetuity, I assume. It doesn't have an expiration date, does it?
Nope. That's the plan, to keep going as long as I'm able to keep making it.
As long as Jimmy keeps going, the Jimmy Akin podcast should keep going. So check it out. You can check it out on YouTube as well. Jimmy's got lots and lots of stuff at YouTube. Let me see. Let's just head back to the phones and see how that goes. Let's give that a shot and see how that goes. Carlos in Dallas, Texas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. We're glad you're here, Carlos. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, guys. Hey, Cy. This is your pal, and I'm still impressed by how you say the phone number. Thank you very much.
Well, I don't know if Jimmy knows this, that Carlos encourages me to slow down in saying the phone number. He's been calling
in it. That case, I heartily approve.
Yeah, you and Jimmy, I feel I'm doing better, Carlos, and I appreciate the positive reinforcement because I do feel like I have attended to your instructions and done better.
I'll tell you, you have, and I'm very proud of you, and I love your show, and I've got my grandson here with me. He's 17 years old. He's a future computer person, and I was just telling him, hey, Martin, Jimmy Akins is on. I got to call in, but I doubt I'll get through because he's so famous. So I'm very grateful I got through.
Well, we're glad you're here.
My question, thank you. So I have two questions in the same theme. So, Jimmy, I was wondering if you can help me. What is the position, the latest position of the Catholic Church, the Vatican, Magisterium, Pope, regarding extraterrestrial life? And then I also have been reading that they're associating extraterrestrial life with the demonic. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on those two questions.
Okay, well, the church doesn't have any teaching on extraterrestrial life, be it intelligent or unintelligent. This is not a matter of doctrine. This is a matter of science. Either extraterrestrial life, intelligent or non-intelligent, exists or it doesn't. And that's a matter of science. That's not a matter of faith. So that's not really a faith question. Having said that, if it turns out there is intelligent or non-intelligent extraterrestrial life, the church has no problem with that. If it turns out there's no life, intelligent or non-intelligent, you know, in the universe besides us, the church has no problem with that either. This is really not a matter of theology. You then have some people who are trying to explain reported alien encounters in terms of demonic phenomena. And that also is not a matter of church teaching. The church does not teach that reported alien encounters or UFOs or whatever are demonic. So this is a matter of theological speculation. If in a particular case, if you have evidence that a particular encounter, whether it's with a UFO or an alien or someone who appears to be your brother Bob, is really a demon appearing in disguise, well, then you've got evidence for that being a demonic encounter. But we shouldn't be paranoid about such things. One of the things about reported UFO encounters is that they don't fit the historic pattern of demonic behavior, just like your brother Bob. I'm assuming, I'm speaking hypothetically here, but I, you know, if you had a brother Bob, demons don't behave the way your brother Bob normally does either. And so it is paranoid to look at something that behaves differently than demons historically have and assume that it must be a demon, whether it's your brother Bob or whether it's a UFO or whatever it may be. That's just paranoid to assume that something must be demons, even though it doesn't appear to act like demons are known to act. And so I would say, can I eliminate the possibility that demons never impersonate aliens? No, I can't. But can I affirm confidently that they are doing that? No, I can't affirm that either. And I certainly don't have evidence to say, oh, they're all demons. To my mind, that is a paranoid approach that doesn't understand Catholic teaching in this area, and that is going to make Christians look foolish and paranoid, because it is foolish and paranoid to just assume it.
What do you think, Carlos?
Wonderful, wonderful answer. And if I may just ask this real quick, Jimmy, what is, mm-hmm. is the, what you just said, your narrative just now, is that your opinion on your personal opinion on the theme that we're discussing?
Yes, that's my personal opinion. It is not a matter of church teaching. As I said, the church has no teaching either on extraterrestrial life or on reported UFO alien encounters. It has no teaching on either of those subjects. This is not a matter of doctrine.
Carlos, thank you for the call. Thank you for calling 888-318-7884. I'm just showing off, Carlos. Let's go to Virginia. Michael in Virginia, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, good evening.
Good evening.
In relation to my question, I'll keep it all brief, but, you know, in my past, I grew up Protestant Christian, mm-hmm. went away from the faith for about 10 years. During that time, followed a few dark paths, and I ended up actually becoming a practicing, like a theological Luciferian, and now mm-hmm. I'm back in the faith, and I'm in the OCIA program, joining the opposite, getting out of the enemy's camp. So with that all in mind, you know, I've noticed my relationships from those 10 years when I wandered away. You know, I've had a lot of beliefs, worldly beliefs about, you know, a lot of things, you know, that are going on in today's world that have done a complete 180. And because of that, I find myself in a position where I have a difficult time. Mm-hmm. I'm basically in avoiding a lot of the people that, you know, I used to know and, you know, used to have, you know, deep conversations with, purely just because of the, you know, the guilt and the shame of where I was versus where I am mm-hmm. now. And I guess, mm-hmm. you know, the question is, you know, how do I keep that, the past from when I was away from Christ, from interfering with, you know, trying to pursue a relationship with these people now that I'm back with Christ.
Okay, so I need to ask at least one clarifying question. These people that you are having, I guess I need to ask at least two. The first one would be these people that you're having difficulty relating to now, you say that you're having difficulty because of shame. Is that correct?
Right.
That you were Luciferian, but you're not
conversations.
Now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where I stand now is much different from where I stood in the past with them.
Okay. And second clarifying question, are these people also Luciferians or are they not?
I only have one friend from that community, and mm-hmm. he's a very good best friend, but mm-hmm. yeah, I find myself not talking to him because he is a Satanist.
Okay. And how would you characterize the other people that you have difficulty connecting with, who are not Satanists?
I
mean, are they like
I
Catholics or non-believers
them.
Or?
Mm-hmm. Oh, Yeah, primarily non-believers.
Okay. Well, so I would say it's understandable that, you know, you look at your time as a Luciferian or a Satanist and you say, wow, that was a mistake. And it's understandable to feel some embarrassment about that. We all have mistakes in our past that we're embarrassed by. I would say there's no need to disconnect from these folks, with the possible exception of your Satanist friend, and I'll come back to him in a minute. But with all the other people, I don't see any reason to say, well, you need to disconnect from them. I would say that how I would present something like this would be to say, okay, yeah, I made a mistake, and by God's grace, he's enabled me to see that. And so I'm thankful to God that he allowed me to make a course correction in life. And I'm grateful that God forgives people who make mistakes and who decide they want to pursue the path of love. And I would present this as a positive thing to them. I would be honest about, yeah, I made a mistake, but thank God he's helped me arrive at a new path, and I'm much happier for it. So that's how I would present it to them. In terms of your friend who's still a Satanist, I would say that you may or may not need to make a break with him. If he, causes you lots of problems, including being tempted to the dark side, but not limited to that, if he's just a painful person to be around, then, you might need to discontinue that relationship. But otherwise, you could use it as a positive. You know, if you're able to present it to him the same way you were able to present it to others and say, you know, well, this was a time in my life and I was mistaken, but God has allowed me to make a course correction, and I'm so happy that he did, and God can do that for you too. You know, then it becomes an occasion of evangelization, and you may do him spiritual good. So I would say all of those things in terms of managing the outward face and sign of your relationship. If what you're concerned about, on the other hand, is the inward aspect of just the emotions that you feel, you know, because we all experience, you know, shame and so forth, unless someone's a sociopath, they will experience some degree of shame when they've made a mistake and they realize it. I would say, just do your best to do what seems appropriate in the moment and try to be a positive influence. Try not to burden others. I mean, you may need to find someone you can talk to, maybe a clergyman, maybe a counselor, maybe a particular friend that you can talk to about your feelings more. But in general, I would tend not to overly burden people with my own feelings of shame or so forth. I would try to manage my feelings in a way that allows me to be as much of a positive influence for others as I can. Are those general principles of use to you?
Yeah, I think so. It's obviously much easier to say than to put into practice, but
yeah,
you know, the past isn't something that can be changed, you know, and yeah, you know, I'm just hoping that, you know, from my own, you know, history, that could be maybe used as a level of understanding when it comes to trying to have a conversation like this with my friend, the Satanist friend. But
yeah. And, you know, also, you know, as they say, time heals wounds. And so these things will not be as sensitive in the future as they are now. And so I would tend to look on this as much as possible as an opportunity. I would maintain humility about my past and about my present and just say, I thank God that he's enabled me to have a turnaround on this issue. And he loves everyone and wants them to have a turnaround from whatever they need to turn around from and pursue the path of love.
Michael, thanks. So thanks for that conversation and that call, and God bless you in your on your journey there. And I'd love to send you a copy of Jimmy's book, The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It. I think you will enjoy it. And if you'd like it, just hang on the line. Nathaniel will get your information and we'll send it out to you. I got to take a quick break. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
Another great podcast on EWTN Podcast Central is Restless. It's four zany Catholic young adults seeking God in the midst of this crazy mixed-up world. They discuss life, relationships, work, fun, and everything else in our world through the lens of our Catholic faith. You can hear this and other faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world at EWTN Podcast Central. Visit EWTN.com/radio and click on Podcast Central today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks so much for being here with us. I shouldn't be surprised, but it is impressive how full the phones have stayed today. Lots of questions for Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's an Ask Me Anything, and we've had a pretty good variety and lots of variety ahead as well. So off we go back to the phones. Elizabeth is in Indianapolis, Indiana, listening on YouTube. Elizabeth, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello. Thank you, Si. Hello, Jimmy. My question is, I'm disabled and live alone, and I don't have transportation, so I haven't been to Mass in a very long time. So I'm clearly not in a state of grace. Are my prayers, like when I pray the chaplet for souls and when I pray the rosary for people, are my prayers valid if I'm not in a state of grace? I know that seems silly, but I'm not going to stop praying, but I'm wondering, are they valid?
Okay. Well, as we covered last episode, valid and invalid are not really categories that apply to prayers. God hears everybody because God is omniscient. So he knows everyone's requests. And Cy Kellett, you may recall an incident where Jesus went to the Sea of Galilee and crossed it into the territory of the Gadarenes.
Yes, I do.
And he encountered a couple of guys who were possessed by demons. And the demons made a request of Jesus. Do you remember what their request was?
Please just don't send us where we don't want to go. Can we go into those pigs over there?
Yeah.
Paraphrasing,
but what did Jesus say? You can paraphrase that too.
Yeah, go into the pigs.
Yeah, so all a prayer request is a request. And so here we find Jesus answering the prayers of demons, and they are most definitely not in a state of grace. So there is value in terms of God does reward. He wants people to do good. And so he wants people to be in a state of grace. And so he may answer your prayers even more if you're in a state of grace. But it is not a requirement that you be in a state of grace in order to be able to pray to God and get a valid response that's positive. In fact, a lot of people, when they're not in a state of grace, one of the best things they can do is pray that God will help them enter a state of grace. And so being in a state of grace is just not a requirement for God either knowing about your prayer request or God granting your prayer request. He can and does do both. Now, he may answer your prayers positively even more if you're in a state of grace, but it's not like he stops his ears and goes, la, 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 I'm not listening to you and I'm not going to grant your request. He just does not do that. Then there is a more fundamental matter, though, Elizabeth, that I want to attend to, which is you said that you're disabled and you don't have transport, and so you haven't been to Mass in a considerable amount of time, and you said, therefore, you're not in a state of grace. But that doesn't follow. merely not being able to get to Mass doesn't put you in doesn't put you out of a state of grace. The church understands that there are situations where people are not able to go to Mass. And if you're genuinely not able, then God understands that. And you're not required to go, and it's not a sin to miss Mass in those situations. So it wouldn't take you out of a state of grace just because you've missed Mass, even for a lengthy period of time. Now, I would say it would be a good thing to explore, you know, is, and I don't know what your mobility situation is, but I would say it would be a good thing to call your parish and see if there might be a volunteer who could help you get to Mass on a more regular basis. But merely the fact that you haven't been able to go because of your disability and lack of transportation, that doesn't mean you're not in a state of grace. So, you know, so I wouldn't be too hard on myself in that regard. You may well be in a state of grace. Even if you're not, though, you can always arrange for a priest to come to you and hear your confession, and that'll put you back in a state of grace. If you're not in one, well, you can, a priest can come to your home and hear your confession and return you to a state of grace there. They could either say Mass at your home or bring you Holy Communion. In fact, they regularly have people who do. Many of them are, some of them are priests or deacons, but others are what are known as extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion, who take Holy Communion to people who are not able to attend Mass, either because of illness or they're in the hospital or they're disabled or things like that. So I would say, you know, it would be a good thing if you're not able to make it to Mass to, you know, watch Mass online or on TV. But it would be even better if you can make contact with your parish and find out, is there someone who could bring you to Mass if you have the mobility and it's mainly a transportation issue? And even then, you can live a valid sacramental life, even if you're not able to leave your home, by having a priest to come to your home and hear your confession, or having a minister of communion bring you communion. And so there are a bunch of options here, and I want to be encouraging to you.
Well, thank you. I did have a priest come and hear my confession a couple of months ago. It was very comforting to have that done.
Awesome. Indeed, as it should be.
Elizabeth, is there a book that we can send you, one of our books? Maybe I can I can send you one of Jimmy's books if you'd like.
Well, I would gladly accept any one of Jimmy's books.
Okay. Nathaniel, are you willing to have another conversation and find a book that, okay, you can go through Jimmy's titles with Elizabeth, and we'll see about which book she'd like. Thank you, Elizabeth. I hope we'll speak again. Off to San Antonio, Texas we go. Emily is listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Emily, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hopefully this makes sense.
Emily, you're breaking up just a little bit. You broke up just a little bit. You said hopefully it'll make sense, and I'm sure that it will, but make sense directly into the phone. We'll see if we can hear you.
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Part of the extended family that I'm a part of is amazing. But their faith is very strong. We've never really had any, you know, big to-dos, I guess you could say, between the different parts of the family. Okay. They have some young children, and there was recently, they announced kind of like in a milestone way, I guess you could say, that one of their younger kids prayed for salvation. And mm-hmm. the non-denominational side of the family, they're very, very, very excited, and it does sound exciting. I'm very confused. I know that they did like a mission ceremony as well at their church, but I try and do my research and understand either biblically or kind of like tradition wise, like where some of that stuff's coming from. But when they said that one, I was like, oh, I don't know why. That's just kind of like sticking with me in my mind, because I'm like,
Emily, I'm not sure what you're asking me. Could you put this in the form of a question?
Yeah, I guess I want to be charitable if the subject comes up in the future of why not just baptize them? Why is like a child praying for salvation like a thing, like that they expect them to do, if that makes sense? It's like, why not just baptize
okay.
them?
So
I don't know if
there
that makes
are
sense.
Certain branches of Christianity where they have a teaching that is known as credo baptism. The alternative position is known as pedo baptism. Credo means I believe. Pedo means a child, and so pedobaptism is the view that small children should be baptized, even though they're not yet of the age to have personal belief. And the Catholic Church is a pedobaptist church. So we, like, for example, Anglicans and Lutherans and Methodists and Presbyterians, all of us baptize children before they reach the age where they really understand their Christian faith. And the understanding is that they're going to be raised in the faith. And so that's one of the promises that the parents make at the time of baptism is that I will raise this child in the Christian faith. But there's a whole other school of thought known as credo baptism that I'll talk about on the other side of the break.
I hope you can hang on, Emily. We have to do this break. This is one we don't have a choice about. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. What can you say to family members who are not baptizing children? We'll continue with that question right after this on Catholic Answers Live. What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, book cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
I'm Deacon Harold Burke Sivers. Join me for Beacon of Truth today at 4 p.m. Eastern.
On the next Beacon of Truth, we're starting our celebration for Christmas as we also look at Soulful Psalm 48.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. There's a little groovy music for you on this Friday. Getting closer and closer to Christmas next Wednesday. Jimmy Akin's our guest. It's Ask Me Anything, and Emily's on the line in San Antonio, Texas. Some family, not Catholic, have not baptized children, and she'd like a charitable way to approach this with the family. Jimmy, you were getting started on an answer.
Yeah, well, it seemed like what she was after was understanding their position. And she said, why is a child praying for salvation a thing? Why don't they just baptize them? And the answer is because the paedo-baptist tradition is not the only one in the Christian church. One of the things that happened at the time of the Reformation was there were a group of people who started, so this goes back about 500 years, who adopted a position known as credo baptism, which is the idea that a person needs to have conscious faith in Jesus Christ in order to be baptized. And so that would mean you can't baptize small children because they don't yet have conscious faith. And so it would be natural in a tradition where that's believed to be the case for it to be a special occasion for a child to decide to embrace the faith and pray for salvation and then go on to get baptized and so forth. So that's why it's a big deal in their circles. And it's certainly a good thing that their children have decided that they want to embrace the Christian faith, that they want to accept God's gift of salvation. All those are good things. It would be, I would say, better if they had, from the time they were very small, been baptized and thus always been in a state of grace, but better late than never. So if someone says their child has just accepted the Christian faith, I would say, great, that's awesome. I might, depending on the context of the discussion, go on to say, you might want to think about this baptism issue and who it's appropriate to baptize, because there's another side to all of this that you may not be aware of. There are better arguments for baptizing young children than you might realize, in which case if that position is true, then you could have God's grace working in their soul even sooner in life than when they are old enough to understand things and make a conscious decision themselves. So I could then offer to hook them up with information on that subject. And we've got a lot of information on this subject on Catholic.com. If you just go to Catholic.com and search on infant baptism, a whole bunch of resources will come up, including ones from the early church that talked about, the early church's willingness to baptize small children, including even biblical discussions of the baptism of small children. Also, I've got videos at youtube.com/JimmyAiken, and my last name is very easy to spell. It is just four letters, A-K-I-N-N, as in Nancy. There is no S, E, or T in it. It's just Aiken, not Aikens, but Aiken, just like it sounds. And I've got a video on why Christians from very, very early days were believers in infant baptism. And so, if you want to go further on the subject of infant baptism with them, we've got lots of resources for you. I would just say you want to be sensitive and you don't want to put a damper on their party, because it is a good thing that their child has decided to embrace the Christian faith. That is something to celebrate. And you don't want to kind of be a scold and nag. It's like, okay, good, your child has accepted Christ, but what you should have done was this. There's a time and a place for broaching, topics of this nature. And in the midst of a celebration, yay, my kid just accepted Jesus, that's not really the time to be bringing up some of these things. That's the time for celebration.
Emily, thank you. I'm going to keep going. I hope that was helpful to you. I'm going to keep going just because it's getting near the end, and there are still people on every single one of our phone lines. Off to Cincinnati we go. Hannah is listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Hannah, are you there with us?
Yeah.
Hi, Hannah. How old are you?
Seven.
You're seven. Well, thank you very much for your call. Do you have a question for Mr. Aiken?
Yes.
All right, go ahead with your question.
In Joseph's dream, how does he know it's a real angel and not a normal dream?
Okay, in whose dream?
Joseph.
Okay, I thought you said Genesis, but are we talking about Joseph, the father of Jesus?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's actually in Matthew. And the answer is, we're not told how he knew that it was an angel and not just his own imagination. But we can think of some possibilities. One possibility is he didn't normally dream about angels, and so when he had the angel appear to him and explain this to him, he just accepted it, and it didn't occur to him that he might dream about an angel because of his subconscious, because they didn't really know about the subconscious, or they didn't have a clear idea of the subconscious back then. So he may have just assumed, hey, I saw an angel in a dream. That must have been a message from God. Then, even if he had any doubts about that, when it turned out that the angel, when he had other dreams about angels that did come true, you know, like when he said, Herod, King Herod is searching for the boy and you need to take him to Egypt. And it turned out that was true. Herod was searching for the boy and he did need to take him to Egypt. That would also serve to confirm that this was a real angel and not just his imagination, like in a normal dream. Also, there's another possibility, which it didn't mention in Matthew, but a lot of times people who have, I'm trying to use words that you'll understand at your age, but there are people who have special dreams. And one of the ways they know that this is a special dream and not a regular dream is it seems more real to them than other dreams. Sometimes people who have these special dreams will say things like, after they wake up, they'll say, this dream was realer than real. It felt really real and it seemed really real. I'm trying to keep my words simple, but that's the basic idea. And so it could be that Saint Joseph had one of these dreams that was just realer than real to him. And so he knew, based on that fact, that it wasn't an ordinary dream, that it was a special dream. And so so those are some of the possibilities.
You know what? Thank you very much for calling us and for waiting so patiently on the phone, Hannah. If there is an adult there with you, if you could give them the phone and they give us an address, we have a book we'd like to send you to say thank you for the call. It's called The Truth Is Out There. It's a graphic novel from Catholic Answers Press. And if you're not ready for it yet, you'll be ready for it soon. So if there's a grown-up, hand them the phone and Nathaniel will get an address to send you that book. I can do another question before I have to take a break. We'll go to Michael in Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Michael, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, thank you, gentlemen.
Sure.
I'm involved in the ecumenical movement pretty long time. I'm 61, and since I was 18, really. And I've been really intrigued with Romans 11 and just the draw of the Jewish people towards the revelation of Jesus, and also the Native Americans. And there's a scripture that this movement I've been trying to understand that's called Towards Jerusalem Council 2, praying for like us Gentiles reinviting the Jews back into full communion. And but they see it as a kind of a parallel with Our Lady of Guadalupe being Native American, drawing us to like finalize the Great Commission, and that the two, like the last shall be first and the first shall be last, is a, you know, like in those eschatological movements of the Holy Spirit. And I just wanted your comment on that, Jimmy, about just Romans 11.
Well, Romans 11 is a whole chapter, and I can't really give you a commentary on an entire chapter of the Bible. Is there a particular verse in this you're wondering about?
Well, like St. Paul says, you know, that if the Jews' disobedience was our opportunity to, as Gentiles, to believe and receive, what will happen when they do believe, but life for the whole world. And so St. Paul seems to be saying to us that you who are of Gentile background, live your life in such a way that you make the Jews envious for the gospel. And then Paul later describes how God has bound disobedience in the heart of the Jew and the Gentile that he might demonstrate his glory through his mercy. And it just seems that listening to St. John Paul II's teaching and Pope Benedict and Pope Francis towards the movements of the Holy Spirit, bringing in, you know, the all the nations, especially
yeah,
the first nation.
Michael, we're coming up on a break, and I want to have the opportunity to answer you. Is there? Can you put this in the form of a question?
Do you see more prayer towards this consummation, if you will, of the Jewish people and those indigenous host nation people coming to a greater attachment to the church that brings a greater clarity to what St. Paul's teaching in Romans 11?
No, I don't think so. I think that St. Paul's meaning is as clear as it's ever been. And so I don't really look to current events in terms of shedding light on things in the Bible. I think we have to take the Bible on its own terms and figure out what it means in its own cultural context. And then we may, once we've done that, we may be able to find applications in our own day. But what you don't want to do is start by noticing things in your own day and then trying to read those as, oh, this must be mentioned in the Bible. Well, maybe it is, but maybe it's not. The starting point for biblical interpretation is the Bible itself, not what's going on today in some context. In fact, this is a big mistake that's made in certain segments of the evangelical community and, frankly, in some segments of the Catholic community, where people start with a just kind of a vague idea of, oh, the Bible mentions something, kind of sounds like this something that's going on today, and reading the two in light of each other. That leads people to perennially conclude, oh, we must be in the last day right now. And people have been concluding that for the last 2,000 years because they're making the mistake of interpreting the Bible in light of current events rather than figuring out what the Bible means on its own and then seeing whether or not it corresponds to current events. Having said that, there will be a final conversion of the Jewish people, at least in bulk, not necessarily every individual Jew, but there will be a large-scale conversion of the Jewish people that will be one of the final events in world history. And we can certainly do things to, encourage Jewish evangelization, encourage the embrace of the gospel in Jewish circles, as we should in all circles. But whether or not we are on the verge of the final conversion, that's something we have to leave in God's hands. We can do our best to evangelize people, including Jewish people today, but whether or not we're approaching rapidly the final conversion of the Jewish people, that's something we've got to leave up to God.
And that will take us straight to the break. Thank you very much for the call, Michael. We got to take this break. Be right back with more. Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 1996. EWTN launches EWTN.com, one of the first Catholic websites in the world. In the late 1990s, it becomes one of the first entities in the world to do video streaming over the internet.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Almost time to get started with my Christmas shopping. Almost time. On the 20th, that's about the right time to start. Jimmy Akin is our guest. I'll tell you what, if I had asked for callers for Christmas, this show would be an avalanche of Christmas presents. Every single light on the phone still lit up with a caller. So back we go. I believe I was going to Michael in Clifford, Maryland. Michael, thank you very much for waiting. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. I have a question. First of all, Jimmy, I've enjoyed watching your journey to faith, and it's been a very it's been entertaining and enlightening.
Thank you.
In the Mass at the consecration, the one thing which this is our Jewish roots, but everyone at the Last Supper, at the Seder, when Christ said, when the evangelist says, he after the supper was over, he took bread, blessed it, broke it, and gave it to his disciples. Mm-hmm. I would think that each one at that table would know that blessing by heart. But I've asked priests, I said, what is the blessing? Now, I've actually looked up the Seder, and I've seen it in Hebrew, and it's very short, and it's very beautiful. It's about, you know, the bread is from the Lord. It actually sounds more like the it's very similar to the when we say blessed be God forever, you know, when he takes the bread and the wine. But I was wondering, it seems incomplete, my point.
I'm sorry, you cut out there, Michael. What was your question?
The last part, Michael?
Oh, you didn't get
just the last part.
No,
you cut out.
You're cutting out.
Yeah, one thing, the blessing, when he takes the bread and he blesses it. Mm-hmm. And the question is, what does he say when he blesses it?
Well, the Gospels don't tell us, and so we can only speculate on the matter. Now, some people may want to base their speculation on later records of Jewish rituals, like you know, the Passover Seders that were recorded in later Jewish tradition, and that is a valid, you know, set of evidence to include as part of the speculation, but it never rises above speculation because we don't know definitively exactly how Jewish Passover Seders were worded in Jesus's time. That's the first reason. Second reason is we don't know, was everyone using the same prayers as all other Jews? There was considerable diversity in the Jewish community in the first century, so there may have been different communities using different prayers for Passover. And then thirdly, Jesus is clearly doing his own thing here, because the typical Passover Seder does not include the Lord's Supper. And so it could be that the blessing that Jesus said was not a blessing that was over the Eucharist, in connection with the Eucharist in particular, was not a blessing that was part of the Seder. It may have been a blessing that was newly introduced as part of the newly introduced Lord's Supper that Jesus was instituted. So we can speculate, and later Jewish Passover Seders may have a little bit of light they can shed, but they're not going to give us confidence here. And since the Gospels don't record the answer, we really can't go beyond speculation in this area.
Well, I'll have to ask him if I get to see him.
Yeah. The Lord, I assume you mean, Michael.
Oh, yeah.
No, you can certainly ask him. He would know the answer.
Thanks, Michael. I'm moving quick to try to get everybody on. Nathan's up in Salt Lake City, Utah, watching on YouTube. Nathan, thank you. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Howdy, Mr. Aiken.
Howdy.
So I've written it. I'm just going to read it off to you, the questions at the end.
Okay.
I've got a friend. We're both former Mormons. You would have figured by me calling from Salt Lake City, right? So I've recently entered the catechumenate. He's been a kind of Protestant Calvinist for a few years. I say a kind of Calvinist because he believes in the apocatastasis and an ultimate universal salvation.
Okay.
But that's just background.
Nathan, just so you know, we're getting real close to the end of the program. We've got a bunch of people who are waiting on the line. Can you just let me know the question?
Yeah, it's dealing with St. Augustine's retractions, St. Matthew chapter 16, verse 18. We were having a discussion about retractiones. We were having a discussion about St. Augustine's interpretation of that verse. His interpretation was that St. Augustine was asserting that the verse he was referencing made the papacy a suggestion, something that one can choose to accept or not. Mine was that it was in context of a argument he was making against the Donatists, and he left the door open for both interpretations. And the Catholic position is that the interpretation that St. Augustine was advancing does not attack the papacy. And so my question is, how far off the mark are we on trying to interpret St. Augustine's writing?
Well, I don't know, because this is not a subject that's easily dealt with in a live call-in radio show, because St. Augustine's opinion is that Scripture has polyvalent meanings, meaning you can find Augustine interpreting the same text in multiple senses, and he doesn't always view them as the different interpretations as being in conflict with each other. St. Paul does something similar with the body of Christ, where in some passages he interprets Christ's body as if he's the head of this body that then is below Christ's mystical neck. But then in other passages, the same St. Paul envisions the Christ's body as a separate entity, as the wife of Christ who's one flesh with him. And so you've got different conceptualizations of even what the body of Christ is in St. Paul. And in the same way, you have different conceptualizations of what the rock is in Matthew 16 on the part of St. Paul. And for that matter, the Catholic Church today, the Catechism interprets it in more than one way. So I can't really in a radio answer look at just one text in St. Augustine, and especially without having the words in front of me, like his retractations, and comment on how verbally summarized expressions of attempts to express his view, how well they do or don't correspond. That's something I'd frankly need more time to do. I'd need the words in front of me, both of the purported summaries and of St. Augustine. If we're asking what's correct here, though, I would say that regardless of what St. Augustine's view was, there are structural features in Matthew 16 that mandate that Peter be the rock, that he is the primary significator of the rock. And so it refers primarily to him. And those structural features, which I've written about on other occasions, are so obvious. They're even there in English. You don't have to resort to the Greek to see them. And so I would say any view that says that Peter is not the primary referent of the rock. I'm not saying there aren't other referents, but if any view that says Peter is not the primary referent of the rock is simply exegetically mistaken. And I would say that to St. Augustine if he was still alive and asking me about the subject. If he at any point in his career implied that Peter was not the primary referent, I'd say, I'm sorry, but that is in disagreement with the way the text is structured.
Nathan, thanks. That would probably mean another retractation from Augustine once he,
yeah.
he would just, that's one of the great things about it though, is like, here's some things I said before. I no longer believe them. That's basically what the retractations are, right? I
think. Well, or at least things he'd modify.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great humility. Thanks everybody who called. We're not going to get to any more calls today, but thank you very much for those.
We tried.
We did the very best we could. You just wouldn't stop calling, but we'll do it again on Monday. So you can join us again then, and we'll try it again, or you can try calling again. Don't forget, there's a big sale still going on. It's a crazy good sale over at shop.catholic.com. You can get full Catholic Answers School of Apologetics courses for just $25, and you can get mini courses for just $10. And Carrie says that the last time we did this sale, it was the biggest, craziest sale of the year. So that's because it's an amazing deal. So head on over to shop.catholic.com. Lots of stuff's on sale at shop.catholic.com, or you can just go to schoolofapologetics.com. Jimmy's got a bunch of courses there. Take some of Jimmy's courses for $25 or even $10 for mini courses. You really can't beat that. Jimmy, thank you very much. I'm sorry we presented you with a virtual obstacle course of technical difficulties, but I appreciate
you. We got it sorted out by the end.
Yeah, we did. We did. And you persevered through it. Thanks. All right.
And Merry Christmas to everybody, too.
Oh, that's right. We won't have you between now and Christmas. Thanks. Thanks, Jimmy. Thanks, everybody who's listening. Get out there. Get that shopping done. We'll see you Monday, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.